Greetings, and welcome to Bear Soup. We have an excellent program this week, so settle down and listen up, bears. First, we have an article from the Village Voice, Straight Men Get It in the End. A call for research study participants. An original piece, a sexagenial tour of Hinsey's Bloomington. Shoutouts, announcements, and the usual bear puns and furry audio foul drawl. There's something for every bear, every cub, so stay tuned. You're just in time for Bear Soup. Welcome to Bear Soup. This is your host, Ron Serratia, Mr. Bear of the Year 2008. According to the independent poll taken by our friends at thecompletebear.com, casting my pod to you through the mysterious tubes of the internets from New London, Connecticut. Presumably you can tell without seeing me that I am recording this stark naked in a hot tub. You're listening to episode number 54 of the Bear Soup podcast, streaming online at bearradio.net Mondays and Wednesdays, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific. For links, pictures, and other information about the stories that we have here on Bear Soup, go to my blog at ronserratia.com, spelled R-O-N-S-U-R-E-S-H-A. Bear Soup is proudly sponsored by our buds at Bare Bones Books, spelled BearBonesBooks.com. Check it out. First up, we have an article from the queer issue of The Village Voice, June 18th, 2008, entitled Straight Men Get It in the End, by Steve Weinstein, who interviewed me for the article. The article does have explicit language. More het guys are discovering the pleasure of bending over, is the caption, over an illustration of a naked straight guy with his butt up towards his female partner who's wearing a bra and a strap-on. So the article by Steve Weinstein begins. Considering how liberated gay men are supposed to be, I'm amazed by how many of my brothers refuse to recognize that some straight men like to get fucked. Yes, you heard correctly. Not bisexual. Not situational homosexuals, such as jail, private school, the Navy, but straight. I wouldn't have believed it either if I hadn't experienced it myself. For the past few years, my ex and I have shared a rampantly straight man who loves to get it in the end. A serious bodybuilder, Ricardo, not his real name, met my ex at the gym. Now separated from his wife, who tired of his serial affairs with women, Ricardo loves the stimulation of a good ass-pounding in between bedding women. On Fire Island, a good-looking middle-aged man told me about a young buck who had been doing contracting in his and his lover's apartment. After a few broad hints, they did a three-way in which he was penetrated. My friend said that he immediately ran downtown to have sex with his girlfriend. Because he was so turned on, he said, although it could have been old-fashioned homo panic. If it feels good for us, why shouldn't it feel good for them? It all comes down to the prostate. DatingSense.com, a website for swingers, explains it this way. Quote, the lining of the anal cavity is rich with nerve endings, and deep penetration may allow for stimulation of the prostate gland, which many heterosexual men also find highly arousing. Unquote. Anecdotal evidence abounds about straight men who enjoy this position. Other gay men have had experiences similar to mine. Gary in Los Angeles tells of a young, cute repairman who worked under him in more ways than one. Quote, we were together every single day, Gary recalls. I talked openly about my adventures. He was peaking sexually, and circumstances came together. One night, the two did the deed. After that, Gary says, he got weird. Last he heard, his former employee was married, a father, and studying become a pastor. That some men are gay for pay is well known, even though most people, straight and gay, remain skeptical. Chris Rockway is a popular gay porn star who claims he likes only women. Although, as he told Australian magazine DNA, quote, sex with men can be fun. Guys get so hung up on labels and what people will think of them that they miss out on a lot, unquote. Dave Pounder agrees. As his name implies, Pounder prefers it on top. A former porn actor who now produces adult films in Boca Raton, Florida, says he wouldn't be able to do anything sexual with a guy and won't even do anal with women. But he refuses to judge anyone's sexuality based on performance. Quote, there are two temperatures, he says, freezing and boiling, but the most measurement is in between. What we need to do is expand our definition of sexuality, unquote. Ron Serratia, who has written extensively on bisexuality, believes that most adults of both sexes have experienced some form of anal sex. Quote, we know how things have progressed, he says. There's been an increase not only in reporting anal sex, but in the practice. Unquote. Sexologist William Fitzgerald reports approvingly on his website, sexdoc.com, of a colleague who rendered the opinion that anal sex for 20 years, starting after 1990, is like oral sex during the 20 years after 1950, when returning GIs convinced their partners that giving head wasn't something only sleazy prostitutes did. Much of this involves a woman in a strap-on, popularly known as pegging, a term coined by voice columnist Dan Savage. The popular porn tape, Bend Over Boyfriend, spawned a whole subgenre of titles like Babes Balling Boys, Strap Attack, and Boss Bitches. According to Serratia and others, what keeps more men from experimenting is a fear that they'll enjoy it too much. It doesn't necessarily lead to homosexual contact, Serratia says. People have to come to understand that when it's done right, it's pleasurable to get fucked anally, regardless of the gender of their fucker. In fact, Fitzgerald notes, quote, homosexual men who acknowledge the pleasure they derive from anal or rectal or prostate stimulation are more centered and grounded about their sexuality, unquote. Of course, this isn't man-on-man sex. But some men have realized that the real thing feels even better than latex. Bob Sanders, who helps run a popular website devoted to muscle worship, has established friendships with several bodybuilders, many of whom like it, he says, because of that prostate massage. Richard Wassersug, an anatomy professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, believes that men who have prostate cancer and can't sustain an erection, an increasingly common occurrence as the population gets older, could benefit from this position. He even suggests that this could be the ultimate gay karma for those who practice reparative therapy, so-called reparative therapy, which claims to cure homosexuality. Quote, assuming that sex ultimately stimulates endorphins and triggers a physiological reward, anything that causes pleasure will be desirable, unquote. Besides, adds Wassersug, who is happily married to a woman, it's yet more proof that gay men have a bigger sexual repertoire. Or to phrase Woody Allen, having it both ways doubles your chances of getting a date for Saturday night. That was an article by Steve Weinstein entitled Straight Men Get It in the End from the Village Voice. Next, we have a men's health announcement. Please participate. The National LGBT Cancer Network wants to do something about the increasing prevalence of anal cancer in our community. First, we need to find out what people know about anal cancer. We are asking gay and bisexual men to complete a brief 5-minute anonymous online survey to assess their knowledge of anal cancer. We are particularly interested in hearing from men of color and hope that you will also publicize this request. The more respondents we have, the more we learn. In the general population, anal cancer is a rare disease, but among men who have sex with men, the incidence of anal cancer is 40% higher and increasing annually. However, the majority of gay men know little about the disease, have ever been tested for it, or even know that screening tests exist. Healthcare professionals, too, remain divided on how and whether to screen for it. In fact, a standardized screening protocol for anal cancer does not yet exist. To participate or to learn more about cancer in the LGBT community and the work of the National LGBT Cancer Network, please visit the website www.cancer-network.org. And you can find a link to the National LGBT Cancer Network online survey on the Bear Soup blog at ronserratia.com. Earlier this year, an anthology that I put together entitled Bisexual Perspectives on the Life and Work of Alfred C. Kinsey was named a finalist for the Lambda Literary Awards in Bisexual Literature. It didn't win, but it was still nice to be named a finalist. I'd like to share a little bit about the process of putting that book together and my own personal encounters with the Kinsey Report. My initial encounter with the book known as the Kinsey Male Report, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, and figuratively with its author, Professor Alfred C. Kinsey, occurred in the early 1970s. Among the many volumes all crammed into two huge identical display bookcases in our living room were my parents' books, including several shelves pertaining to sexuality and eroticism, and both the male and female volumes of the Kinsey Report. I was keenly aware of our copy of the male report, for, as a young man curious about his own desires, it was where I first read anything verifiably true about homosexuality. This imperative search for information on homosexuality was naturally clandestine, and, as I was prone to spontaneous arousal at the merest hint of sex, this investigation required privacy for a length of time. I confess that my first perusal with the Kinsey Report simultaneously impressed and confused me with its great many charts and graphs, which looked promising as a source of scientifically researched information about sexual practices, but frankly not so interesting as a source of erotic stimulation. Even for a precocious youngster, the book's thickness and scientific tone, pages filled with tables and charts, made it daunting, but I hoped to ascertain the one thing that mattered most. Because of my erotic desire for other boys, called homosexuality, I was different from most people who are heterosexuals. This was a revelation and a relief, because I definitely was not going to sign up to be a homosexual if I had to dress up and make up like a girl. But I also liked girls, at least I had no problem with them in some of my fantasies, and sometimes I fantasized about boys and girls, mostly boys, and other possibilities. Now I understood that homosexuality meant that you were a guy who liked doing things naked with other men, or with other women, for girls. It was not really about how you dressed or acted on the outside. Like perhaps most people who bought the book assumed or hoped, soon enough I realized that the Kinsey Report was not intended as erotica. Still, as I recall the instance, I had an erection for at least part of the afternoon, and at that age, just reading about erections could give me one. Soon enough, After finding some of the much-needed information pertaining to my foremost questions about my sexuality, Kinsey's book was reshelved in favor of a coffee table collection of Aubrey Beardsley illustrations and The Joy of Sex, which quite efficiently stimulated sexual release, followed by a hasty cleanup before someone returned home. Just a few years ago, knowing my bibliophilia for all things Kinseyan, my husband presented me with a delightful gift, a copy of the Kinsey Mail Report found in a Mystic bookshop. Its red hardbound cover peeked over the worn corners of its faded orange dust jacket. Its copyright page revealed that this copy was from the 8th printing, and that it went through its first 5 printings, beginning May 5, 1948, in less than a month. My first thought was how serendipitous it would have been if this had been our family's book, which, along with hundreds of its companions in the bookcases, was sold in 1977. About the time that I became aware of the 2005 Kinsey biopic by Bill Condon in production, I anticipated that 2008 would be the 60th, or the sexagennial, anniversary of the publication of the Kinsey Report. I suggested to Journal of Bisexuality editor Dr. Fritz Klein a special commemorative issue with an eye toward examining the connection between Kinsey and bisexuality. Fritz was enthusiastic and wanted the project to proceed, but sadly he passed away the next year. Fritz's successors at the American Institute of Bisexuality and the journal graciously agreed to sponsor a special double issue published December 2008 by Taylor and Francis Journals, with a Routledge UK hardbound trade edition to come out later this year. An immediate response to the call for papers came from Dr. Brian Dodge, one of the nation's top sex researchers at Indiana University, who contributed a significant lead article in collaboration with his colleague, Dr. Michael Reese, and with one of the surviving members of the original Kinsey research team, Dr. Paul Gebhard. Yale law scholar Dr. Kenji Yoshino and Kinsey Institute Director Emeritus Dr. John Bancroft graciously agreed to add their perspectives in brief interviews. Lammy-winning by entertainment writer Mike Szymanski contributed a major article examining all aspects of bisexuality connected with the film Kinsey. Additionally, we received original pieces from Dr. Jennifer Gurman in Sydney, Australia, and from U.S. by activists Bill Burleson and Carol Queen. My friend and occasional writing partner, Jay Neal, wrote a loving bibliobiography, a short story describing the life of a copy of the Kinsey Mail Report as it changes hands over 6 decades. I contributed 2 additional pieces for the journal. First, a research article on the publication and translation history of the Kinsey Reports, including the 1953 Kinsey Female Report. Neither of the 2 main biographies, Alfred C. Kinsey, A Life by James H. Jones, and Kinsey, Sex, the Measure of All Things, by Jonathan Gathern Hardy, had thoroughly chronicled the publication history of Kinsey Reports with translations into 13 languages. This was very peculiar, considering that the Kinsey Reports are considered by far the most popular scientific texts published in the 20th century, and that Kinsey himself was an avid, anal, some would say, book collector and cataloger. The second piece I wrote was a travelogue of Kinsey's Bloomington, which I want to outline here. In October 2007, I attended the Indiana Sexual Health Summit at the Kinsey Institute and stayed on campus at the Indiana Student University while doing research at the Kinsey Institute archives during a temperate and colorful homecoming weekend. As I explored the amply decorated halls of the Union Complex, along the crimson-bricked paths and out into Bloomington, I kept expecting to find a fitting memorial to Proc, as Professor Kinsey was known to his students, a formal portrait, signage, any tangible tribute to him. First on my Kinsey sexagennial tour was the library and archives of the veritable Kinsey Institute, housed on the top two floors of a near-anonymous campus building. Even with a campus map, you'll miss Morrison Hall, nestled in a cluster of other similarly sized and colored science department buildings, obscured by plenty of mature trees on three sides, every window framed with metal bars. Although the Kinsey Institute offices are listed on a board in the building lobby, there's no sign from the outside of Morrison Hall bearing the Institute's name. Access is available by elevator only to the third floor reception office, where they offer tasteful Kinsey kitsch, Kinsey Institute t-shirts, mugs, and other Kinsey collectibles. Approved visitors then may ascend by stairs only to the fourth floor to conduct research. The Kinsey Archives are a queer studies student or sex geeks mecca. The highly disciplined staff offered enthusiastic and helpful support of my modest research subjects. The anonymity and secrecy of the place are palpable from outside, but inside, the feeling is not unpleasantly hypersanitary. The droll restroom labels, male and female, clearly indicate that humor is in play, balanced by a practical unisex facility nearby. Kinsey biographer Jonathan Gathern Hardy felt this rarefied atmosphere was blanketed with an air of, quote, paranoia that continues to hang about the Kinsey Institute like a miasma, unquote. My much briefer impression of the Kinsey Institute was cheerier, but even still, if you're actively looking for the place, the surrealism of its public invisibility is hard to miss. Half a mile southeast from Morrison Hall, nestled in an idyllic spot, is the house that Alfred Kinsey had built. On the lot he and his wife Clara acquired in 1926 at 1320 East 1st Street, in the gingerbread homestead where they raised their family. A large, quiet, woodsy setting, the Kinsey residence is, quote, the most charming and eccentric house in Bloomington, as Gathern Hardy describes. Kinsey had the builders construct the exterior walls with extra mortar, which oozed out between the dark, burnt, red-brown bricks, giving the exterior this very rugged yet sensual texture. I recognized the property immediately from photos that I'd seen, but nowhere was a marker indicating the house was of any historical significance. So I checked the number and confirmed with the neighbor that this was indeed the old Kinsey residence. Surely the home of one of America's most famous scientists, not to mention such an unusually designed place, would have been made an historic landmark. There must be some mistake, I thought. I trekked 2 miles west, just south of downtown Bloomington, from the Kinsey home to the Rose Hill Cemetery on West 4th Street, where Alfred and Clara Kinsey are interred. To locate the gravesite, I had for visual reference a photograph of noted sex researchers Diane DeMauro, John Gagnon, and Gail Rubin visiting some years ago, but it wasn't apparent from the photo where in the cemetery the burial plot was located. After wandering the length of the cemetery, looking for the Kinsey gravesite without luck, I finally located it. Here, engraved on 3 tombstones in the final resting place of Alfred and Clara Kinsey's mortal bodies, the place that marks their lives and deaths, finally I had discovered some material evidence of Kinsey's existence. That evening I walked into town for dinner and a visit to Bloomington's sole gay bar. Although there used to be several queer bars and nightclubs, the last remaining small-town gay bar is Uncle Elizabeth's on North Morton Street. Despite its modest setting, the bar was decorated for Halloween and folks were in a festive mood. I looked around the many posters and displays on, as they call it, Uncle E's double-wide trailer walls, but saw no trace of a connection, whether to Kinsey the man or the Institute. In fact, in speaking with some of the locals, most of them were aware that there was such a thing as Kinsey Institute and a professor named Kinsey, but none of them knew where the Kinsey Institute was located on campus. My 2007 Kinsey Town Confidential Walkabout was an attempt to encounter Alfred C. Kinsey's public presence as a local historical figure. Kinsey, once considered the most famous man in the United States, named Dr. Sex, whose books were likened to the atomic bomb, seems almost completely unrecognized outside Morrison Hall, where the institution bearing his name is housed. Following in Kinsey's footpaths 60 years after he traversed the sidewalks and streets of Bloomington, I wondered why Kinsey the man is deemed undeserving of even a single-framed portrait or photograph. Perhaps someday it will be safe to outwardly acknowledge and memorialize Dr. Alfred C. Kinsey, some place in the small Midwest city where he lived, or on the university campus where he taught and wrote his two masterworks of sexological social science. Two books that changed the way the entire world looked at sex and gender. They are books that reflected the true lives as lived by millions of other persons of infinite sexual variety around the world. And yet, they are books not on the shelves at the Indiana Student Union bookstore. No likeness of Alfred Kinsey is evident, whether to haunt, honor, or grace the university halls or elsewhere in Bloomington, yet traces of Kinsey's iconic presence abide there, like so many other aspects of sex, potent and hidden wide open. We can only hope that the conspicuous absence of a fitting Kinsey tribute is remedied sometime before the Kinsey centennial. From the Merman, Joe and Reggie from Metrocast, Scott and Mike, Jack Chapman. Bubbles for the Bear Soup Hot Tub are powered by our sponsor, Bare Bones Books. Please check out their fine titles by Bare authors at barebonesbooks.com, spelled BearBonesBooks. You've been listening to Bear Soup with Ron Serratia. Bear Soup is news, opinions, stories, humor, and interviews for the bear community. Look for Bear Soup also on Facebook. And please feel free to contact me at bearsoup@gmail.com. This is your host, Ron Serratia. Thanks for tuning your furry ears here to Bear Soup.